Thank you, Rachel, and thank you, everybody, for coming. It's such an honor to be here and an honor to perform with Mark and Don as well. Thank you so much. Was this your idea to do a show at the MoMA Library at Burn Porter?
Yeah.
Has Burn Porter ever had a show at MoMA before?
I don't think so.
No, no. Has he ever been in a show before at MoMA? No?
Not at MoMA.
Is that no? Not Mark. Is there on the resume? Is there something that Burn has done? Had his work exhibited at MoMA?
No.
No. Okay. Well, wow. What a visionary and wonderful thing you've done. Really, it's a really, really special. I'm going to read a piece that Burn wrote in 1955, when he was living in San Francisco, entitled "Clothes." I am male. I wear standard male clothes. That is to say, my clothes are exactly like the clothing of every other male. This morning, fresh from the shower, I stepped into a pair of shorts and drew them to their proper height while buttoning the lower button. I pulled over my head the standard sleeveless undershirt, tucked it under my shorts, and buttoned the top two buttons. Men who are smarter than I am put the shirt on first and draw the shorts up over it. Note that I now have probably all that propriety demands. Shorts and a shirt. Now, I have about two layers of clothing on my waist, but I have about one layer on my legs and my chest. And note that I have used three buttons, or the equivalent snap-ons. I've gone through nine separate motions to get into this state, and now notice that as I continue dressing, I will merely be donning an elongated version of what I already wear. I pull on my trousers, draw on, and tuck up a dress shirt, making a total of four layers of cloth about my waist, with one layer on my arms and my legs. The adjustment of the trousers front and belt after getting them on consumes all eight separate motions. Then following the folding of the cuffs and the insertion of the links and the placement and the adjustment of the armbands, the collar is next, with buttons or equivalent front and back, plus the necktie, and a finicky operation which allows males to primp and preen at their best. At this point, I have seven pockets. I have used 13 buttons, and I've gone through 41 separate motions. I'm at last ready to put on a fifth layer of cloth about my waist in the form of a vest. It has four pockets on the outside, one secret pocket for supposedly secret purposes on the inside. The vest has five more buttons and requires six more body movements, and possibly the adjustment of a strap and buckle arrangement in the back needing five more movements. I am now ready for my suit. That is to say, I'm ready for the sixth layer of cloth about my waist. I am ready for three more buttons and four more pockets. This I accomplish with a six-body movement, followed with a final adjustment of the ensemble, which includes the insertion of a billfold watch and two handkerchiefs in four of the 17 pockets now still available to me. Straightening again the tie and the collar brings the total to 67 movements, not including, of course, the socks, shoes, and garters that I put on after my trousers were in place, and with 12 exacting motions. Note that I am now ready for the wars of survival as we know them. In short, I am dressed. Note that I now have on 11 separate garments or items. Note that these items have 28 appurtenances. Note that my legs are now covered with a single layer of cloth, that my legs 5 inches above and 5 inches below my kneecaps. Note that the 14 buttons have been used, two shoelaces, two cufflinks, two armbands, one belt, one tie clasp, two collar buttons, one necktie plus one zipper, two garters, and seven buttonholes, which are not really buttonholes, but only imitations of them. And for some unaccountable reason, six of these false seven buttonholes have buttons, but the seventh does not. Obviously, I am now neither scientifically, logically, nor functionally and aesthetically dressed. I have expended a quarter of a million movements in the 36,000 times I have dressed myself these past 40 years. Moreover, the way out of this unfortunate tradition and profit-bound dilemma is both obscure and difficult. I will begin by combining a vest and a shirt in one piece. And I'll combine two of these with the undershirt, and then I'm going to add the coat and the jacket for a 4-in-1 unit, the whole without pockets, armbands, cufflinks, collars, buttons, collar buttons, and I'm going to combine the trousers with the undershirts, and I'm going to drop in the process the cuffs, one belt, three pockets, and all buttons. I am seeking a single piece affair with the necktie, the most useless apparel, and yet the one object of greatest affection and most difficult to part with, being the last to go. My first one-piece all-occasion suit, not including stockings and shoes, has no cuffs, no collar, no tie, no belt, no double thickness at any point, and only three pockets. The requirements of porosity, flexibility, freedom of movement, warmth, and low production cost plus functional styling necessitate considerable research with materials ending in the creation of woven paper, glass, and tin textiles, each made from the commonly wasted byproducts of civilization. Glass bottles, tin cans, and waste paper of all sorts, woven plastic, cellophane, cork, linoleum, and wood are also being tried, along with many natural reeds and fibers growing neglected and unused in great abundance throughout the world. Coupled with this search of mine for materials is the first study ever made of the engineering structure and design of the body, an analysis of its movements and functions, the better to design the first garment ever conceived from these obvious viewpoints. Interestingly enough, the ultimate suit is a coated or sprayed-on type, which is instantly removed by dissolving with reapplication as frequently as is desired. Any wanted thickness or color or combinations of color are, of course, possible. An intermediate or somewhat popular model of my design having built-in soles or shoes is dispensed from slot machines and is disposable in toilets. Similarly, I investigate the wear spots on seats, elbows, garment edges, subject to handling and wear. Methods of keeping materials perpetually clean and soil-proof and permanently preserved are equally examined. And it is while comparing the stylization potential of American-made shoes with the ready functionalism of a Japanese sandal that I attack the wear-down features of heels and toes and the wear-out characteristics of leather shoes, sidetracking the complaints of the highly organized shoe repair industry and the shoe and hide producers who are always pleased to have their shoes deteriorate rapidly. I set up motion picture cameras of varying speeds on busy street corners in the first known attempt to learn how people walk and just what strains are produced, at what points, how to correct them, either by changing a walking gait or by reshaping the footwear itself. Thus, I make thousands of stress, strain, and motion studies. I carefully investigate thousands of materials. And as the work goes on in this controlled and investigative manner, I foresee that the human skin can never be improved upon. Might, under the right conditions, be made to grow a suit better, a given purpose. Thus, by special vitamin injections into skin structures in the soles of human feet, I develop there a heavier, tougher skin which takes all conditions of use without the need of additional protection or covering. The human foot, for the first time in history, is taken for what it already is, a thing of great beauty, great functionalism. Unadorned feet at last come into their own. The only problem is to teach people to use them so that their natural beauty can evince itself. The same is true of all body parts and coverings which I developed. Skin alone is superior. It cannot be excelled. These exhaustive studies produce then ways and means of making and being the body beautiful. How to sit, how to stand, how to walk, or how to run. More important, how to supply, reserve, and build in it natural conformity to its true self. The effect of my work is to change radically whole segments of existing industries. Clothing as we know it is no longer made. Unemployed garment workers become teachers of the body beautiful. The once shoe manufacturers make devices of leather for rubbing and exercising the body. Cleaning and dyeing establishments, weaving and carding mills are taken over by huge new cosmetic industries now having an entire body to cover with oils, perfumes, paints, and preparations of the trade once limited to heads and hands. In fact, as the work advances, the sprayed-on coverings of my early design, the disposable one-piece suits, the shoes with high heat-treated spring steel soles, the suits with the wear-out proof seats and elbows, the master special that has no pockets but carries all necessary extras pinned on, the moth-proof, fade-proof material whose weave and color design changes by simple exposure to ultraviolet light there, and a staggering number of innovations for clothes coming from my personal studio are made obsolete by the simple discovery that the human body without embellishment is superior to anything that can be prepared. The contribution of this great and thoroughly tested truth to the proper areas of the world's population who currently practice it in part but need further experimental confirmation is, of course, tremendous. It only remains now to see that this body is properly fed, rested, exercised, and made disease-proof.
Within a week or so, I went to his house, which was known as the Center for Advanced Thinking, and had been trashed and gone through many times. Before I got there, he wasn't really living there for a while. The door was open. I walked in. I sat in. There was no furniture in the place. There was a lawn chair, a broken lawn chair in the living room. So I sat there, and I just sort of felt his absence. And after a while, it got dark outside, and so I decided to leave, and I walked outside. And then I remembered that the way the light was, and then that twilight darkness falling, across the street, and this is a narrow street in Belfast, Maine, homes are very, very simple, and across the street there was a white picket fence of that plasticized kind of wood. I don't think it was wood, and I remembered that those people had told a reporter in Belfast that they had to put up a white picket fence because Burn Porter was stealing all their children's toys and putting them in galleries downtown as art. But what's even better is that because these people had this feeling about that, they had gathered all of these toys and they had put them up against their door, their front door. So there was a stack of all these Easter-colored toys, if you know what I mean, these sun-faded pinks and reds and little wagons and buckets, and there was a big stack of them, and in the falling light, there was this, their porch light was lighting them, and I just stood there, and I said, you know, it's a Porter piece. You know, it's perfect. So it's a pleasure to be here tonight, and it's a great opportunity to read, and it is a fictional biography because obviously I don't have access to the voices from Porter's past. But I do have to say, and I do get asked about this, the incidents described are true. So you will hear some stuff Porter had a very colorful life. It was also very painful at times. And I just wanted to know that I'm not making up. I don't have to make up stuff when it comes to Burn Porter. There's more than enough material to work with, that's for sure. So I'd like to, I'll introduce the first piece. And this is Catherine Squall. From Porter Settlement, Maine. This is her voice, Catherine Small, Porter Settlement, Maine.
I know when it started with me because Burn Porter was born the same day, February 14th, 1910. I was carrying a basket into their kitchen with one egg in it. Snow was stuck in my hair and I was shaking cold. This was in their little house next to Old Man Porter's barn. I had scattered corn in the barn for their chickens and found one brown egg in straw. Where was my mother? That's what I think about. Was she in the back room helping Burns' mother? I don't think so. I felt alone. Who brought me down the road? I was 9 years old and our house was 2 miles south. A storm was blowing, snow coming under the door. Did my mother walk me to their house and leave me there to work? Or did Lewis Porter drive a horse and sled 2 miles in drifting snow on the day his son was born to come and get me? How I got there is the part I can't remember. I was carrying the basket to the pantry. I walked by the cook stove. The firebox under the burners hissed. I stopped and stood near the heat. The oven door was open, and I saw a baby in the oven. I gasped, and the egg rolled out of the basket, broke on the floor. I couldn't breathe. Louis knelt up next to me, and with one arm around my shoulders, I asked him, "Did you kill the baby?" He said, "No, honey," keeping him warm like rising dough. I looked at the broken egg on the pine floor, a spot of blood in the yellow, and Louis's arm moved down, his hand on my hip. His other hand held a piece of paper in front of my face. It was torn from a catalog and had a black heart on it with an arrow through it. He said, "Happy Valentine's Day, honey." Women were talking in the back of the house, but I didn't call out. Louis's face was close to my neck and his hand was moving on my leg. I kept my eyes on the poor baby sleeping in the oven.
And the next voice is Etta Porter from Fulton, Maine.
I know I sound cruel, but I had to put Bernard out of my thinking. I loved him dearly when he was born. He was my first. But he screamed when I lifted him up, twisted in my arms. As soon as he could, he crawled away from me, shuddered when I kissed him. It was not what I expected. I said things to him I should not have said. I wanted to hold him, read to him at bedtime, teach him music, but he would not let me. And soon enough, there was no time for anything but working. Grandmother Porter moved to Holton and left me the only woman on the farm. I cooked for the hired men 3 times a day and for Grandfather and Louis. Grandmother would come to the farm after church to visit, but she stopped helping. Louis brought girls in from other farms to work, but I had to teach them everything, and they would disappear when I needed them. I had more children, Harold, and then Everett, and then Marion. After each birth, there were women who pitched in for a few days and then left me alone. I will tell you something about Bernard that breaks my heart. Marion was 2 years old when she took ill and died. Women from the Grange and the church helped me bury her. I knew if I stayed in that farmhouse another month, I would die myself. I demanded that we move off Porter Settlement to Helton. Louis did not want to go, but because of Marion's death, I could not be denied. It was Marion's dying that got me off the farm. Bernard loved Marion. When she died, he changed. He would wander from the house, walk the roads for miles, and spend the day at her grave. He was 10 years old and lost in the world. Bernard drew pictures of Marion, beautiful pictures, perfect likenesses, and he would surround the pictures of her with numbers. I watched him lying on his stomach in front of the wood stove for hours upon hours, scribbling, drawing her face, and doing arithmetic in her hair, figuring problems.
This is the voice of John Crawford, Fulton, Maine. If Christ resurrected appeared above me as I read the gospel at Easter, do you think my congregation would take faith and trust God? If I were home, my wife would hush me, say I have been the Fulton Grange chaplain 25 years too long. She doesn't want to hear what I know, but I know my people. They are fearful. They're afraid of strangers, of Indians, of Catholics, of taking sick, of bears, wolves, snakes, and lights floating in the woods. They dread each season as it comes. They scatter after service, afraid someone will catch them in a lie, because it's a lie we choose to live. More homesteaders every day stepping off the train, needing shovels and picks, axes, lumber, bullets, and seeds. We outfit them, sell them dry goods, bacon and flour, take the coins they stitched in their clothes and point them down the rails, say, "There is land you can claim northeast, only a day or two away." We know most of them
will not last out a year. They will lose children. Mothers will die sick. They will starve or freeze. We see it, but we are willfully blind and seek no cure from Christ. We would rather live in terror because we covet their coins. The porter boy knows this. He meets the train every day after school. He watches the homesteaders arrive and looks right at them, follows them to the livery, to the Douglas store. I've seen him sketch their faces on butcher paper. He knows what will happen to them. I see it in his eyes. He's a new creature, this boy. He's afraid of nothing. The next voice is Althea Brockway, Holton, Maine.
For a teaching job advertised in the Boston Daily. After an exchange of letters, I was offered the position. I accepted and moved to Holton, Maine. I exhausted most of my savings during the trip and was just able to rent a very small house on School Street. 2 weeks after I arrived, a salesman came to the door selling the Fuller brushes. His knock, only a moment after I had walked in, startled me. He looked familiar, but I had never met him before. I politely refused his demonstration, and he gave me a sample, a narrow, bakelite brush not practical for me. It wasn't until later that I realized why I thought I knew him. I had seen him in the grocery with the young boy that walks around town. You might see this boy anywhere, dressed properly and walking alone with purpose and a quiet expression. The Fuller brush man was the boy's father, a Mr. Lewis Porter. Later, I would hear rumors about Mr. Porter and the daughter of a sleigh maker. The headmaster told me that the young girl was not right and perhaps prone to exaggeration, but still, it was not something he wanted to hear about. And the way he knocked when I had just entered my house bothered me. He could only have been watching me and waiting. I felt uneasy after that and came to believe that I was being watched by Lewis Porter. His son's name was Bernard, and he came to the high school that September and was one of my art students. He was smart and a talented draftsman. I encouraged him to study art history. He did not talk much, but when he did, he projected his voice across the room. I spoke to him about that many times. There was something going on inside of him, and at times, he had to work hard to control himself. I knew more than a little about that, coming to Holton as I did with limited prospects due to my own personal recklessness. I told Bernard he must learn that there are times to hold back and not let anyone know he contains such a powerful voice. The boy was full of life, and he was completely alone. I tutored him after school. I did everything I could to let him know there was a world outside of Maine. My feeling of being watched grew much worse. Lewis appeared everywhere I went. He tried to talk to me many times, but I walked away from him. After each encounter, he grew more persistent. I carried a long hat pin stuck in the spine of my purse, and I was willing to use it. I considered leaving Holton to escape Lewis, but I stayed for one reason only. I stayed for Bern Porter.
The next voice is Dr. Carl Barris, Providence, Rhode Island.
For 58 years, I developed methods of accurately measuring extreme temperature and pressure. After I read Bernard Porter's master's thesis on alpha particle range measurements on radium, I sent him a letter inviting him to audit my lecture on radioactive elements. He sat in the back, and as I spoke, an angle of yellow afternoon light illuminated his hair like licks of fire. He was unusual in his manner, tense in his chair and staring at me. What happened after class was unfortunate, and I regret my words. I understand it is common for an older man to reevaluate the direction of his life, but there is no excuse for what I did. I believe our meeting would have been different had I been younger when I met Mr. Porter. I would have praised his research and talked of ways we could help each other. Instead, over tea in my dining room, I told him I doubted science could help mankind survive. I told him it is a strange faith to believe that the individual efforts of scientists around the world will unite to lift all of us to a place of peace. I told him it was probable we were doing more harm than good. I watched him hear my words. I saw the impact. It never occurred to me that I was speaking from a privileged position. I had my books, my home, my family, tenure, and money enough. I had my place in the scientific community, and what was I telling this newcomer? I wonder if there was not some terrible jealousy at work. I looked into the eyes of a young believer and told him the fears of a failing old man. The truth is, science has always been a refuge for me. I am prone to hurt people without intending to. My life has been an experiment, the results of which I could not predict. I truly did not know that my words to Mr. Porter would create a reaction that would engulf his life.
Albert Einstein, Princeton, New Jersey. When Hitler took Paris, I became deathly ill. I had family and friends fleeing Europe, or lost, or murdered, and their faces came to me in nightmares. In the morning sunlight, I felt old and exhausted. I knew, as my colleagues here and in Berkeley and Chicago knew, that two of the universities the Nazis now controlled had completed uranium experiments more advanced than anything we had ever done. I wrote a letter to Roosevelt about this, warning him. He ordered the military to draft hundreds of scientists, and they arrived in Princeton by the trainload. Those who taught and worked here at the university were overwhelmed with the talent. My sickness worsened, and I stayed home, trying to work in my upstairs study, but unable to concentrate and failing to accomplish anything. One afternoon, Bern Porter came to visit me. I knew of his book and knew he was not a theorist, but a practical and thorough investigator. I knew why they had assigned him to Princeton and where he would be placed in the research lab. My wife brought him upstairs because I was too weak to take the stairs myself. He wore slacks and a white shirt, and his hair curled in waves high on his head. He said he had come to personally invite me to his art opening at a downtown gallery. He said I might be especially interested in his sculpture made of human bone. He gave me a photograph. He said he found the leg bone while hiking in the New England woods, and the form of it was so beautiful he had to make it into a sculpture. His eyes were bright as he talked about it. He looked at me as if I understood the secret of what he was doing, but I did not understand it at all. He left after a few minutes, and I was disoriented. I pinned the photo of his bone sculpture on my wall and tried to see what he saw, but it made no sense. What kind of man would pick up human remains and make something of them? Long after he left, and ever since then, Porter's enthusiasm nags at me. I don't know why, but it is impossible for me not to love someone like that. After his visit, my illness gradually disappeared, and I could work again. The next voice is J. Robert Oppenheimer from Berkeley, California.
I asked to meet Bern Porter when I was visiting Princeton for a conference with the S1 Uranium Committee. One of my students had used Porter's thesis on the electromagnetic separation of radium rays as the basis for a presentation table that simplified my calculations, confirming the amount of U-235 needed for a bomb. I knew the Army had assigned Porter to Princeton. At the conference luncheon, I asked a number of Princeton scientists where I could find Porter, and they had no idea who I was talking about. They said that whoever he was not part of the social circle there. A young woman, a waitress, overheard me and said that she knew Byrne Porter and that his photographs were on exhibit at the University Arts Gallery. After the meal, she walked me to the exhibit. She was a photographer herself, a Hungarian who had escaped Germany with Moholy Nagy, a design artist from the Bauhaus School. Porter's photographs were simple, dreamlike, and evocative. I remember the titles, Semblance of a Devoted Past, Whose Valley Home, and Faith of a Thousand. Lines taken from the writers Proust, Joyce, Henry Miller. The woman, Ilko, arranged for me to meet Porter in a bar downtown, and the three of us sat at a table in the dark and drank coffee. Porter's eyes were wary, scanning everything around him. He wore a worn leather jacket over a plain white shirt. He talked for a long time, and Porter asked me if I knew where the research was going. Was I ready to accept it? I told him it was coming no matter what I did. It would be us first or the Nazis. I told him that the Army Corps of Engineers was organizing a gigantic project, one that would replace the S-1 community. There were millions of dollars committed and hundreds of scientists would be drafted to work on the effort. I said he would most certainly be involved. He said he could only hope there would be peaceful uses of the coming discoveries. He said he expected that I would be chosen to lead the project. I told him I was sure that would never happen. I told him I had been interviewed by Army security and it was clear they considered me compromised because of my political friends. I joked and told him my girlfriend openly calls herself a communist. Ilka leaned toward me and said, "Brilliant is silver and easy to burn." Porter said, "They will choose you because you are compromised."
And the last voice tonight is Betty Friedan, Berkeley, California.
Do you have the FBI files? Is that it? You have minutes of the FAECT meetings so you can place Byrne Porter and I together in Berkeley in 1942? Does the FBI still claim that the Federation of Architects, Engineers, Chemists, and Technicians was created by the Lenin School of Espionage? You know, if that's true, then the Soviet spies were hopeless. Those meetings were a mess. Men smoking cigarettes and pipes in the living room of a worn-out mansion on Chattuck Avenue, arguing about meeting procedures. My head was full of the psychology research I was doing with Eric Erickson. I watched the men try to dominate each other. I placed them in developmental stages. It looked like childhood mostly, except that they scratched their balls more often. My boyfriend was right in there with them, scratching and smoking. I noticed Byrne Porter in the back of the room, dressed in a loose white shirt and dress trousers. He stood in the corner, eating the communal oatmeal cookies and watching everything. He ate more than his fair share of cookies, I noticed. He was not a communist when it came to cookies. He had big eyes, was about my age, and was certainly handsome. If this was a meeting of spies, then he was a spy all right, but not the kind of spy they wanted. We ended up together on the back porch, overlooking a yard crowded with blossoming gardenias. I complained about the hot nights, and Byrne said there was often an inversion layer over Berkeley caused by the heat generated by the tidal flats. He said at night, when it should get colder, the warm air trapped above Berkeley suddenly descends and the night gets very hot. He said the heat did not matter to him. He had no love of sleeping. When he left for a moment to get a drink, a woman told me that he was one of the physicists at Lawrence's radiation lab, working long hours and under some kind of brutal deadline. He never once mentioned that to me. He returned and asked me if I had a car. I had a sun-faded red 1940 Ford coupe. He asked me if I would drive him somewhere and offered to pay for gasoline. He said something tremendous was going on. He had heard about it in one of the galleries on Telegraph Avenue and had to see it for himself. I left my boyfriend at the meeting and drove away with Burn Porter. We drove west, out of Berkeley, along the edge of Tidal Flats, into a town called Emeryville. It was industrial buildings and empty lots full of abandoned structures. Burn pointed to the horizon and laughed. "There," he said, "look." On the gray sandy flats ahead, there were large sculptures built of driftwood and metal junk, huge things held together with rope in the shapes of schooners and horses and swordsmen and on and on. Some flew flags of tattered cloth. There must have been 30 or more of them. My first thought was, what kind of crazy person goes out on the muddy sand and builds these things? Then Byrne was yelling, "Stop!" And before the car had quit rolling, he was out, and his shoes flew off, and he rolled up his trouser legs as he walked out onto the flats, yelling, "Come on, Betty, come on!" From the high tide line, he gathered driftwood and junk and fishing string and pieces of netting and began to make sculptures. I took off my shoes and stepped onto the wet flats. They were warm and solid, and the sand felt good. At first, I gathered some pieces of wood and laid them near Byrne, thinking I would help him. But he said, "You must build one," and so I did. Byrne created two sculptures, both about waist high. He twisted the driftwood into abstract shapes that seemed full of movement. I made a little person, and then one a little bigger, and then another bigger still. I was thinking about human development again, children. The sun was setting, and the red sky came across the shiny flats towards us until our clothes were pink, and our faces too. After a while, we walked toward the car, turning back many times to see what we had made. Her sculptures were tiny compared to the giant structures beyond that must have taken weeks to build. But our work was there, standing upright on flat earth. I drove barefoot to a diner with a sign outside, the Fish Shack. Byrne showed me how to make a red-eye beer. He poured a shot of tomato juice in the bottom of a tall glass and then slowly poured cold beer in. It made a beautiful color and tasted salty and delicious. We ate shrimp and crab meat and French bread. We were young, but we were becoming something. We could feel it in each other. I drove him home to his apartment, and before he jumped out, he leaned toward me and kissed my lips. There was static electricity in the air, and a spark jumped from his lips to mine. It hurt a little, and we reacted in surprise. Then he was out of the car. That was all that happened between Ben Porter and I. But you know what? On the tile flats, I made three figures, a little girl and two little boys. Later on, you know, I had three children, a girl and two boys. One of the boys, Daniel, hated to sleep. One bright afternoon when he was a young man, he explained to me that some nights are warm because there's a layer of hot air that descends from above. I'm not a sentimental person, but for some reason, I felt like crying. Daniel grew up to become a physicist.
Thank you. Thanks.